remember when I getting one.
Yeah. I think Harvey walked away with it, actually.
Did he really?
No,
wouldn't surprise
just
me.
Kidding.
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay.
So, I am Jim Milstein. I am the master of this ceremony today to give my good friend Ken Buckfire the Harvey Miller Outstanding Achievement Award in restructuring. But before I give him that beautiful bowl, we're going to have a little conversation while you all have the rest of your lunch and talk about the business. But I first want to, I don't think Ken needs a lot of introduction to this crowd, but Ken has certainly earned this high award. He's really one of the leading restructuring bankers and has been for, you're probably
way too long.
Embarrassed to say for how long. I've known Ken. Ken and I think did one of the first deals each of us did as a young partner and a young managing director. We worked on the restructuring of Van Camp Seafoods, which was chicken of the sea for those of you who don't know the tuna business, a long, long time ago. But Ken has done really, besides creating a very successful firm in Miller Buckfire many moons ago, he used that platform really to become and do some of the biggest and most notable deals over the last three decades. Among which are the first prepackaged Chapter 11, something called Edgel Communications in 1990, one of the largest out-of-court utility restructurings in Niagara Mohawk Power. The first convertible DIP loan that we worked on together. I was the buyer, you were the seller, and we created a debtor-in-possession loan that, by its terms, converted into equity of the restructured company, assuming the company got restructured. And it was a very quick bankruptcy.
Yeah, 6 weeks.
In and out. The first public common stock offering by a bankrupt company. This was an amazing case, General Growth, done during the middle of the financial crisis. And his most recent notable achievement representing the city of Detroit and putting together the first municipal debtor in possession loan. If we could only do that in Puerto Rico.
You can tell us how you're going to do it.
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
That's for another day. So the cases that he's worked on are really too numerous to go through, but some really big, notable, prominent cases in which real innovations in the way finance was practiced in and around troubled companies. And he has many loyal admirers and colleagues here today, people who've worked with him over the years. So welcome to all of you for this high award. So Ken, we're going to talk a little bit about your life in restructuring. But so the sort of first question is, how did you end up in this crazy line of work?
Well, unlike you who were born to it, I got into this field by complete accident. When I first graduated University of Michigan, any other people here from University of Michigan? Good.
Jack,
of course. Go Blue. I ended up working for a big insurance company and wound up being a junior analyst on one of the very early airline bankruptcies, Braniff, because we were the second largest creditor. And the banker who was advising them was a guy named Steven Fenster, who some of you may remember. And I was fascinated by what he did. So when I went back to graduate school, I wrote him a letter and said, "Dear Professor Fenster," he was at Harvard then, "I'd like to learn how to do restructuring. Where should I go?" And he goes, "Well, come work for me. I'm coming back to Wall Street." And I started working for him at a small firm called Dillon Reed. And it was completely an accident. I had no idea what any of this was. And all I knew, I thought was really fascinating stuff. So I started doing it that way.
And from Dillon, my recollection,
Lehman
Brothers. And then
Wall Street and Pearl.
And then Wall Street and Pearl, and then you and Henry.
That's where I met Henry.
Yeah. Spun it out. And Henry, because Henry had been at Solomon to start.
He'd been at Lehman and then Solomon.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I listed some of your accomplishments, but you tell me what you thought the highlights had been.
Well, it's funny when you look back on the work you do, and I'm sure all of us have the same feelings, that the ones that are closest in time always seem to be the most important. But when I look back on what I've done, I think that the one that I would say was most technically challenging and I took the greatest amount of technical pride in was actually Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation, which probably most of you don't remember because it never went bankrupt, never saw a judge, never even defaulted. But it was incredibly complicated because this was a big upstate New York utility, which at the time had foolishly signed power purchase agreements with 19 separate power producers, which had escalations and they couldn't get out of it. So they were going to go bankrupt very slowly and then draw all at once. And we were hired by the independent power producers, all 19 of them, to basically figure out a consensual out-of-court deal. And the hardest thing, of course, was getting 19 separate power producers, all fierce competitors, to sign our engagement letter. That was really hard. And the negotiation on that actually was harder than getting Niagara Mohawk to negotiate the restructuring. But what made it really difficult, and a lot of you will appreciate it, was we not only had 19 separate clients, but they had collectively 65 separate projects, all with different fuel types, all with different power supply contracts, all different transmission contracts, on the order of something like 380 separate contracts, all of which would have to be restructured in turn, so those projects would not on their own go bankrupt. And it was incredibly complicated to do, and we did it all in 12 months.
Really?
Yeah.
In 12 months?
12 months, and it was $19 billion of total obligations.
And what triggered the, was it a massive change in commodity prices?
No, it's just because the law at the time said that if you were an independent power producer and you were selling from a plant under 50 megawatts, the utility had to buy your power at their avoided cost. So you had this gold rush of people up in upstate New York building these stupid power plants, which were completely inefficient. But because they could take advantage of this regulatory quirk, they were making an absolute fortune.
Right.
The problem was that the utility itself was in a declining, stagnant territory, and they had flat revenues because the Power Commission would not let them raise rates. But their cost of power kept escalating. And so they knew within 18 months they go bankrupt. Huh. And that would have just devastated upstate New York, devastated all these companies. So. At the time, DLJ was advising this corporation. We organized all the independent power producers at their request. And at the time, I thought the odds of getting something done were about 10%. But we were able to figure out a paradigm of how we allocated the value in such a way that to this day, we're the only people who actually know who got what out of that deal. Because all these power producers were competitors. And they didn't want anyone else to know what they were getting. So it was all very interesting and technically extremely complicated.
So that, and that's a theme that I think that, you know, is underappreciated by some of the new entrants in our business, that, you know, this is a classic case of a group of creditors to the utility, in effect, who's own, the solution to their own problems relied on a solution to their debtors' problem.
It was a classic prisoner's dilemma problem, which you're facing in Puerto Rico now, of course. We won't talk about that. But clearly, you know, the solution there, which is typical of most situations, is every creditor always wants to do better than the other creditor, but if they all cooperate, they'll actually do better than if they try to compete for the small amount of value that's around. And Niagara Mohawk was a great example of that fact, that because they trusted us to be fair as their banker, we were able to allocate value, and none of them knew everybody else was getting, but they believed us, that they actually did far better by cooperating than they did by trying to opt out through litigation and trying to preserve their contracts, which would have destroyed not only their own value, but this very important upstate utility.
And so when you got that done, at the end of that, though, did you require Regulatory Commission approval of the new power contracts?
We did.
And was that easy to obtain, or?
It actually was not that hard because we'd kept them up to date the entire time. Mm-hmm. And I went to Albany, I don't know, 8 or 9 times with the banker to the company to explain it all to the staff. So by the time we formally brought the rate order to them, they were fully aware of it and there was not a problem getting it approved because they recognized that as part of it, we were not going to be increasing rates, which is all they cared about. And as long as we met that condition, they were okay approving the underlying transactions, which was, you know, massive. They had to do, I think, $9 billion worth of financing in order to deliver value to our clients, which included giving us collectively 28% of their stock.
Cool. So this raises we're sort of in a new era post the financial crisis in which the intersection of the restructuring business and government is obviously much more prominent, both by virtue of the interventions that the federal government made in the financial sector and in the auto sector, but also now given how indebted governments generally are, both state, local, and our own government, but there are obviously a variety of sovereigns around the globe who have are facing some significant headwinds. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about, you know, the experience of doing a restructuring in a political context, since hot off the heels of your recent success in Detroit.
You don't want to talk about Puerto Rico?
No, I don't want to talk about Puerto Rico. We're here to talk about you.
I'm giving you time to word it edgewise. Okay. I think that, you know, one of the major lessons that we learned from the city of Detroit, where we were involved for nearly 3 years, was the importance of complete transparency, that we had not only done a huge amount of homework to really understand and diagnose the problems of Detroit, but we didn't hide anything from anybody. We told everybody exactly what we found in painful detail. We told everybody what our proposed transaction would be. We didn't hide anything from anybody. And we also set out fundamental principles at the beginning of the process, which we never deviated from. And so I can tell you that at the beginning of it, you know, everybody hated everything we had to say because nobody wanted to confront the truth of the situation, which you're dealing with now in Puerto Rico, of course. But I think because we really held to our principles of what we were trying to achieve, and we literally made every effort to be completely transparent at every step of the way, that allowed us to allow the political process to coalesce around our plan, not because they liked it. Nobody liked what we had to say, but nobody had anything better. And it was really, I think, more a reaction to that than anything else that allowed it to be successful.
And at what point did, I mean, were you hired by the emergency manager or by the city before the emergency manager was appointed?
We started unofficially advising the governor back in January of 2011 when I met Andy Dillon, state treasurer. I wrote him a letter. And I said, "Dear Andy, I think we can be helpful in Detroit." And he was kind enough to come meet with us. And so for 2 years, we started helping him think through, you know, the strategy, how do you formulate this, the need for an emergency manager. And we began officially working for the city of Detroit in the summer of 2012. And then we became officially the bankers of the city in January of 13, but the city did not hire an emergency manager until March of that year.
Did not elect to have an emergency manager under the state law.
Correct, but right. They had the right to appoint it. And in fact, the state met the emergency manager during the pitches for law firms to do the restructuring in Detroit. He was one of the Jones Day partners who came and pitched for the assignment.
Right. And so do you think the, in effect, the suspension of politics by the creation of an emergency manager statute and giving the emergency manager the, in effect, the power of the local city council and the mayor and the right to pull the trigger on Chapter 9, the commencement of a Chapter 9 proceeding, was that a critical element of actually making the politics and the finances come together?
Unfortunately, I think it was. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable question because you think about the fact that in the United States, democracy in a city was suspended for 18 months. I mean, they might have voted for a mayor, they voted for city council, they had no power because it was all in the emergency manager's hands. One could argue that was an expression of state democratic politics,
yes,
right, in the state process. But nonetheless, you know, for the first time since the Civil War, we effectively had the equivalent of martial law. You know, that's a very uncomfortable thing to think about. Was it necessary? I think the evidence is that it was. But I think what made it palatable to the citizens of Detroit was he only had an 18-month term. So everybody knew that as uncomfortable as it was, he was going in 18 months, and so were all of us. So if you didn't like it or whatever you felt about it, it didn't really matter because the passage of time guaranteed that by the time the governor got reelected, a mere coincidence, of course, we were all gone. And that actually not only created a deadline to get everything done by, but it also meant that if you really didn't like the fact that your mayor, who you voted for, had no control, it really wouldn't matter. All you had to do was wait a few more months, and we did disappear.
Yeah, but this is in the sort of in the kind of constitutional law of municipal government, right? Municipalities are creatures of their states.
Right.
They derive their powers from, in effect, a delegation by the state to the municipality of certain of the state's sovereignty within a given geography, within a limited set of home rule regulations, and so. The democracy isn't so much suspended as a superior sovereign is dealing with its child and saying, all right, you guys couldn't get it done, we're taking over.
And that is the argument, but in theory, you're absolutely right. I didn't go to law school, unfortunately, so I defer to you on that.
I'm just helping you.
I know, you're helping me out. But that wasn't how it felt to the citizens of Detroit.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's right. But the emergency manager had the power to actually drive a deal.
He could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
And he did.
You know, it is, I mean, we see this, you know, there are various examples of this. I'm not going to talk about Puerto Rico, but there are various examples of how difficult it is for the politics to come around the kinds of changes that are needed when a sovereign or a municipality gets in trouble. The ability to really kind of step back and say, all right, we actually have to change the way we're doing business as a government is very hard to effectuate politically.
Well, there's also the fundamental problem that politics is, of course, at its root, an allocation of economic resources to whatever groups have the ability to vote themselves benefits or demand that the government changes their priorities, right?
That's a very Republican view.
I'm not a Republican, though. I'm just a banker, but that's how people do things. But the problem was, whenever you get into a situation like Detroit, and frankly, one of the most profound lessons from the governmental restructuring there, which has not been followed in other places, is we were given very clear instructions by the state government to make sure that if Detroit had to go through restructuring, it would go through it once. No second try, we'd get it done right. And what did that mean was we had to make Detroit a place people actually wanted to live, which it wasn't, all right? That required an analysis of the budget to figure out, well, how do you make Detroit a livable place? And it turned out it cost $1.5 billion over 10 years of investment to make it a habitable place. So once you say you need $1.5 billion from the revenues, because there was no bailout of Detroit, really, that what only was left over goes to the creditors. Well, think about what that means. Rather than in other governmental situations where you have interest groups or creditors arguing over the pie, and nobody really cares about the quality of life, in Detroit, the priority was quality of life, and then we'll figure out what the creditors get, including the pension funds and everybody else. And that lesson has not been given enough attention in the press, because it's not a very sexy thing to talk about. But that was actually the most crucial battle in the restructuring of the city of Detroit.
Yep.
And I think the proof of the pudding is now, since it's been over a year since we've emerged, you know, the attitude in Detroit and the number of people moving back to the city, it's truly remarkable. But that's because city services are being restored. And in other places like Stockton and Vallejo in California, where they frankly forgot about public services, nobody wants to live there. And those solutions have not worked.
Yeah, this is the sort of curious thing about, you know, municipal financing within basically a monetary union and a national union is people vote with their feet. If they don't like the way the government is delivering its services or the quality of life that's available in that jurisdiction, they just move. And this is something that's going on in Puerto Rico as well. And this is, you know, the problem for municipal finance, for state finance, really for federal finance in an era where various municipalities, states, and nations are competing for capital and talent, human capital and technology and investment, and is that people vote with their feet. And at the end of the day, it's the revenue stream that's available for servicing debt is your tax base. And your tax base is a function of your population and the diversity and energy and economic activity created by your population. And if your population is declining, it's very hard to pay debt incurred in one era that's due 30 years later. Very hard to do, because in effect, you incur debt with a tax base of this, and your tax base is now this. The debt's still there, but the tax base has shrunk. And so the only real path to creditor recoveries in Detroit was to turn the city around, because the trends were not creditors' friends. All right, so what did you learn? What have you learned over the last 30 years about human nature, about the restructuring business, about the nature and changing of our capital markets?
I think that looking back now over as long as you've been doing it now, actually.
For sure.
It's a long time. This restructuring used to be, you know, back when we started doing it in really a black art. There were like eight people who might have read the Bankruptcy Code on Wall Street. I mean, nobody read it. Certainly were lawyers, but nobody really understood it. There were very few people who did it. Nobody invested in it. But now it's become just another asset class. And I think that's a very profound and sort of very fundamental shift in the way people think about companies and governments that get in trouble. It used to be, God, you went bankrupt. You were obviously terrible people, and you should be, you know, disbarred or sent to prison or something else. Now it's just, well, bad luck. We'll fix it and move on. And that's actually a very important change, far more here than in Europe. In Europe, it's still a terrible thing if you get in bankruptcy. Here, nobody really cares anymore, because obviously what it really means is that you're betting on growth that didn't occur and you can't refinance your debt. That's generally speaking what happens. What that also means is that the market has become very, very mature, and the speed at which we can fix companies' problems is now vastly greater than it was 20 or 30 years ago, even 10 years ago. And I think the next thing you're going to see even more so in this next cycle, which is beginning, than we saw before, is that the capital markets are going to be willing to step up and refinance these troubled companies. And the people who take the exit financing securities, or whatever we create in bankruptcy, are no longer going to be the creditors who bought the paper. And if I've learned anything else over the last 20 years, every time we get into a very busy cycle, you see more innovation coming. And I think that'll be the lesson of this one, that you're going to see people mark these assets to market. You're going to see more cash outs of creditor claims. And it's not just going to be converting debt to equity. You're going to say to people, if you don't want to participate in, I'll take you the security, I'll find a new buyer to buy it. And I think that is what you're going to see in the next couple of years, which will be, I think, kind of the last change that we see, because there's no real reason why the people who buy the distressed debt are the natural owners of long-term securities. They're really the bridge owners. They're the ones who understand the process and they'll fight it out. But really, many of these companies, especially in the resources sector, really cannot be financed appropriately by the distressed investors. Their assets are much too long-term, it's too variable. They're really more thought of now as the bridge to a new balance sheet that'll be created post-bankruptcy.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think over the course of the last 30 years, the big changes in our business have really flowed from the big changes in the capital market. So when we both started, you know, the people who populated a balance sheet that needed to be restructured were banks and insurance companies. And now you'll have a bank that has syndicated a loan, but just as likely it's CLOs and other institutional investors are actually the participants in that loan. And the bank who put it together, arranged it, has got a very small economic interest in it. They've workout departments have largely been shrunken, if they exist at all. And the insurance companies are really small players in long-term corporate finance now compared to the institutional market, the mutual funds, the hedge funds, and the like. But I agree with you. I think that's a very real insight that the distressed investors are really just bridge lenders.
Yeah.
They're there to pick up the paper that the banks and other, you know, par buyers can no longer hold because everybody's in a mark-to-market environment virtually now. And they hold it just as long until we can find someone who's a long-term holder on the other side of the restructuring to take it away from them.
And I think you're also going to see that the kind of companies that the distressed investors end up holding for a long time are the truly broken companies that can't find a bid in the regular capital markets after being restructured, because there's operational issues. There are industry changes. For example, in shipping, where we've done a lot of work over the last couple of years, shipping companies, by and large, don't make money because the day rates are below operating cost. And why is that? Because China has 145 shipyards and they keep building ships. It doesn't matter how good an operator you are, you're not going to make money in an environment like that. So who is financing shipping companies? Well, it's the big distressed investors, because nobody else wants them.
But they may find themselves holding
very
long dated asset before that market gets into balance again.
And so it's going to take a long time to fix.
So we talked a little, I guess, with a natural segue is kind of where do you see us heading? I mean, the interesting thing, I talk about this stat all the time now, is that, you know, we had a huge run up in debt to the financial crisis in 2008. Both in the financial and the non-financial sector. Since the recovery started in 2010, you've had a not much deleveraging in the financial sector, mm-hmm. but a huge run-up in debt again worldwide yeah. in the non-financial sector. Debt to GDP levels worldwide are higher than they've ever been. They're higher in the United States than they've ever been. They're higher in Europe than they've ever been. They're higher in China than they've ever been. They're higher in the major emerging markets than they've ever been. And there's, I think my sense is that there's a, I mean, everyone's nervous about it, but no one's doing anything about it at all. And so I think things are very delicately balanced right now, mm-hmm. and that any kind of major economic shock would reveal just how weak the underpinning of cash flow supporting all of that debt actually is, and that we could be on the verge of a huge yeah. boom in restructuring again, unfortunately for the world. I don't know how you see it.
Well, I agree with you.
Sorry, I didn't
of course,
understand.
I agree with you. Yeah,
you're fire, but.
But I think more seriously, I don't think anybody really knows how this will play out because there are some very powerful factors that underlie the growth in debt. The first one, which people don't give enough credit to, is that the governments themselves are the biggest beneficiaries of zero interest rate policy. When you think about how much debt, for example, the United States has accumulated over the last 7 years. But the fact that our interest rates are near zero means that the cost of servicing the gigantic federal debt is lower than it was in the mid-2000s. And that's actually true around the world. So you have governments that actually have now a vested interest in subdued economic growth, because what do we all know about robust economic growth? It tends to drive the cost of capital up. And governments don't really want that, because if rates go up, the only way that works is if tax revenues go up faster than interest rates do. So they actually are on the other side of the trade now from a rates point of view. I think the other issue that is...
Oh, by the way, the central banks, the Fed, the ECB, and the People's Bank of China are each huge owners of interest rate sensitive securities, that if there were a... Not that they're mark-to-market players, but... The treasuries and agencies on the Fed's balance sheet, if marked to market in a rising interest rate environment, would imply massive losses on those portfolios.
And I think the other fundamental factor, which even the New York Times has now figured out, which means it's old news, but is that you can't ignore demographic trends. I mean, from 1945 to 1978, we had very long-term sustainable economic growth around the world, primarily because population growth was very robust, and it was all working-age populations, very young populations who were working hard. So productivity was high, consumption was high, and you had a very benign environment that overall supported everybody. But now you have, in every major developed country in the world, rapidly aging populations, people who are getting older. You know, you have your cars, you have your houses, your children have gone to college. You don't spend money anymore. You save money or you don't spend it. And so you have underlying all of this subdued economic growth, because the major driver of growth, which is consumption, fundamentally can't be supported anymore by the population as it gets much older. So when you look at the fundamental trend of long-term cash flows, I agree with you that the trends are not in favor of long-term corporate profitability, because people aren't buying stuff. It's not exactly a secret that not only in the United States, but in Europe, corporate revenues have been basically flat for the last 7 years.
But profits have been going up because right. of cost cutting and the global platform company and right. outsourcing to lower cost producing areas. I mean, it's a worrisome trend for the various developed countries' citizenry, where are those jobs going to come from?
And you also therefore have the fact that, at least in this country, interest on debt is deductible. So at least from a corporate finance point of view, debt seems cheaper than equity. So if you're trying to finance yourself, that's why the average credit rating for most companies now is double B, whereas 40 years ago it was single A or better.
Right.
But now people have read the book and they say, oh, that's too expensive, I'm going to finance more cheaply. And that's why people have levered themselves up, because they think debt is cheaper than equity. But debt is only cheaper than equity if you can repay it. And if you can't, then the cost is infinitely high. And so we're now going to be in an environment for the next 5 or 10 years that if you accept the fact that you have the fundamentals for robust economic growth are simply not there, And as people pile up more and more debt, they become more risk averse, which means they invest less, which is the other side of it. Absolutely right. We're looking at a long-term era of what I would consider deleveraging, if for no other reason that that's going to be required to access the capital markets again.
Let's hope. So I think we have another 10 minutes before.
Mr. You ran out of things to ask me.
No, I haven't.
The audience will bail you out now.
I'm ready to rock and roll here.
Okay.
The oil and gas sector obviously has been subject to booms and busts. Actually, my first really cut my teeth on a restructuring in 1984 that began really when after OPEC had run up in their boycott and around the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Led to the second big run-up in oil prices as a result of the boycott. And as a result of that run-up in oil prices, just as we saw over the last 10 years, there was a huge surge of investment into the sector. Drilling rigs, supply ships, pipelines, looking for new reservoirs that could be accessed at the higher prices than prevailing in the market for a barrel of oil. But of course, the commodity sector is always subject to these booms and busts. And so you had overinvestment, greater production of oil, and the price collapses as a result of supply and demand getting out of balance again. All of those plays that had been created to chase those higher prices with levered investment in the oil sector came crashing down. And so the first big one that I worked on in 1984 was a company called Global Marine, where Harvey Miller, who was across this table from me and taught me how a big public company restructuring went. We're seeing that again now.
Yep.
Same dynamics. With a little less sign of what the exit from this price decline will be, because OPEC has lost its power. OPEC still had power; it was still 60% of the market in the 80s. Now it's less than 35% of the market, and really they're on the margin, not capable of controlling supply, and therefore not capable of controlling price. So I don't know quite what actually happens here to bring this market back into balance. I've sat in some of our mutual clients' investment forums for their limited partners, watching them talk learnedly about how the market's going to come into balance in 2017 or 18 in their bear case. I don't see it, actually. I think that there's a gross oversupply, huge invested capital in the sector where, you know, a little cash flow is better than none at all. And so people have an incentive to keep producing and producing and producing. And I don't really see how the supply is going to get taken out of the market.
I don't either. I mean, part of the equation that people don't pay much attention to is that the demand side of the oil market, and in some ways of the gas market, has been completely flat for the last 2 years. You know, the China 8% annual growth, when they were the biggest consumer by far of oil, is not there. I mean, they may talk about 7%, but they're lying. And so I think you have to be realistic about the fact that the supply of oil would be just fine if there was a demand to take it up, but it doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, there are, you know, we're seeing two decades worth of investments in energy efficiency in the auto sector, mm-hmm. As well as in the utility sector, mm-hmm. really dampen the growth in demand, both for gasoline as well as for electrical. For electricity. And so I think that there are a lot of money, distress money, mm-hmm. now running into the oil and gas business that's going to be a much longer bridge, yeah. than people are anticipating.
I think that's right, but I think you also have to be very careful to distinguish between at least in the United States, the oil sector and the gas sector. Because a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money in gas because there's a lot of gas around, number one, but gas is also in all the wrong places. You know, there's a tremendous amount of gas discoveries all over the United States, but a lot of it is trapped because there does not exist the infrastructure to move it to market. And even if you could move it to market, the natural use of gas is to displace coal as a generation fuel, which is why all the coal companies are going bankrupt, because they're starting to see the end of that industry. Mm-hmm. And the problem, of course, is that U.S. national policy does not encourage the construction of gas-fired generation and the early shutting down of coal plants, because utilities, of course, need these assets to justify their rates. And if they were to shut down all the coal plants without being allowed to charge the stranded cost, they'd all go bankrupt. So there are going to be a lot of very profound impacts on the U.S. electrical generation industry in the next 5 years as people attempt to deal with these long-term factors, because ultimately, if the utilities are really being smart about this, they'd go to their commissions tomorrow and say, we want to shut down all of our coal plants in 4 years, we want to build all new gas-fired plants, but we want to keep those coal assets in our rate base for 10 years to recover the money, because otherwise we go bankrupt.
Yeah. No, and I mean,
and they won't do it.
You know, from a climate policy, from a economic policy for local development and making sure there's a nice smooth transition between employment in the coal industry, employment in the fracking business, all of the, that's a very sensible policy, but getting that done, really hard to do. And that to me is the real, again, going back to this theme of the intersection of finance in a highly levered public and private sector, mm-hmm. and politics, it's the thing that really worries me. I worry about our political capacity to create consensus around, you know, clear and obvious transition plans, mm-hmm. such as you just outlined for the energy industry in the United States and for the utility sector in particular. Because these are huge industries that have huge sunken investment.
Right.
And you know, many pensioners depending on that dividend and interest stream out of the utility sector, and making sure that transition actually works is key, both to protecting pensions as well as to protecting jobs and employment.
Well, just to finish up on this point, I'll try to save you some money now. If you own utility stocks, look at them very carefully and make sure you don't own any which have significant coal assets in their generation fleet, because the people who analyze these coal stocks, first of all, they don't know how to read balance sheets, right? And the guys who do credit analysis say, well, it's in the rate base, it's fine. But you can't avoid the fundamental transition factors like this for very long. And there's a reason why, actually, utility stocks are off a lot this year. And it isn't because interest rates are prospectively going to go up. The smart money is looking at them and saying, I don't necessarily want to be long utility stocks, especially the guys who burn coal. Because coal eventually is not going to be at the margin in great demand in this country. Anybody who's got a coal plant is eventually going to have to shut it down, because gas is fundamentally a cheaper and superior fuel to run generation with than coal. It's not even a close call, but it's getting the utilities to do it is going to eventually lead to some political intervention, and the politicians are going to say, shut down these coal assets. And then the utilities are going to say, well, who's going to pay the bill for it? And the commissions will say, well, you are, of course.
Right.
God forbid the ratepayers pay it. And then you're going to see either very subnormal economic performance for a long time or actual bankruptcies of some of the big utilities, which absolutely nobody's expecting. But it's definitely going to be out there.
Well, I mean, just to segue to the truth into Puerto Rico, the truth of that in Puerto Rico, right? We have a fleet not of coal burning plants, but of diesel burning plants that, you know, are really from the last, way into the last century.
Yeah.
And that is a utility that has to move to gas, both because of the lower cost of natural gas, as well as the better burning characteristics, mm-hmm. of gas. But they've got the stranded cost of the existing plants and an inability to raise the capital to finance the construction of the new plants. It's a transition problem extraordinaire.
And that's where your cost per kilowatt hour 29 cents.
Well, today it's 21, but
well,
you know, we have had a slight decline in the price of diesel.
Right.
So final question. Why the hell are you still doing this? You've been very successful. You could be, you know,
I'm waiting
playing
for you
golf.
To retire. I'm not going to be the first man to go.
No, but you and I are like dinosaurs now. It's hard to imagine.
I'm not a dinosaur.
No, but we're like the oldest guys in the business now.
That's true, actually.
You know,
Tim Coleman's
older. Tim Coleman's a little
older. He's older than us, yes.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I've never found anything else I wanted to do. I mean, these are some of the most complex problems that you can solve. And it's a lot of fun to be able to solve them, even though it doesn't feel that way sometimes when you're doing it. And I think it's a very worthwhile way to spend my time. So I'll keep doing it until you retire.
All right. Well, and on that note, I am going to present you with the
a bowl.
This lovely bowl. It's the Harvey R. Miller Outstanding Achievement Award.
Oh, I'm so happy.
So there you go.
Thank you very much. I feel great about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
So I don't know when Jack. You're next on.
I think like 5 minutes back in there.
Okay, great. Oh, all right. Well. Yeah. You know.